So for those of you that are familiar with World War I, probably know that it was started when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated. But I came across a story that I hadn't read before that was connected to these events. And so in 1914, there was a young man named Gavrilo Princip. And he was sitting outside of a deli in Sarajevo eating a sandwich. And he was bummed because just a few minutes before, his attempt to assassinate the Archduke by a bomb did not fail. Don't you hate it when that happens? And so he was sitting there sort of eating a sandwich, upset. And it seemed like his mission had failed, that he had missed his chance to accomplish his goal. But then something very bizarre happened. The driver of the Archduke's car, which was getting him away from the bomb scene, took a wrong turn, and they stopped right in front of the deli where Princip was eating a sandwich. And so Princip couldn't believe it, what was happening. And so when they sat there, he then pulled out his gun, fired, and this time he successfully killed the Archduke and his wife. One unexpected accidental turn sets off a chain of events that leads to World War I starting. And sometimes it's these detours that shape our entire story or a large part of it. And that's what we're going to see in Genesis chapter 38. Genesis chapter 38 seems like a chapter that's out of place. And in fact, some pastors, when they're going through the book of Genesis or going through the story of Joseph, skip the chapter completely. But this is the exact place where God moves in a very surprising way. Now, you may be wondering, why? Why is Genesis 38 out of place? And I'm going to give you two reasons why. First of all, it interrupts the story of Joseph. And so we're going to not start on it until next week. But chapter 37 begins the story of Joseph. And so poor Joseph is attacked by his brothers. And he's then sold off into slavery to the Midianite traders. And so then all of that happens in chapter 37. And then all of a sudden, chapter 38, you would think would continue with the story of Joseph, but it doesn't. Chapter 38 moves away from Joseph for just one chapter and then focuses on Judah, one of the brothers who attacked Joseph. So Genesis 38 seems like this unimportant sidetrack, but by the end of the chapter, I hope that you're going to understand why it's included here. But to make matters worse, another reason why it just seems very out of place is because it's a very explicit chapter. And by the way, don't worry, I practiced this sermon yesterday afternoon in front of all my kids. They were actually not sitting there, but they were in earshot all doing their different things. And so nothing inappropriate, super inappropriate will be said, but we're going to talk about some of the weird things that people in Genesis did. And so the content is enough that some pastors throughout history have completely skipped the chapter as well. For example, let me read what one theologian said in his commentary. He said, "This is the most sexually explicit narrative in Genesis. For this reason, some preachers may wish to give this chapter a wide berth in preaching a series on the Joseph narrative." But if this is the case, then why am I preaching through the passage today? And the reason is this. Chapter 38, Genesis 38, is really a powerful example of God accomplishing his plan through people, even though they are seemingly unimportant, even though they are rebellious, even though they are deceptive, even though they are sinful. And so all throughout this chapter, we're going to see various people committing all sorts of different types of sins, of rebelling against God in different ways. And yet, God still accomplishes his plan. And so that's actually going to be the sort of the format or the outline of the sermon. The first two-thirds of the sermon, I'm going to focus on the different sins that the people commit as we work our way through the chapter. But then at the end, I hope to show you how God still accomplishes his will in spite of everything that takes place. And so let's go ahead and let's start working our way through the chapter. And here in the first few verses, we see sin number one, and that is a rejection of God's commands and family beliefs. Let's start in verse one. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. There, Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. Now, again, this happened just after the story of Joseph in chapter 37. So just after Joseph was sold into slavery, Judah leaves the family's area and goes down to hang out with the Canaanites. And in fact, verse 1 says that he went down from his brothers and turned aside. And that language there is pointing to his essentially rejecting the ways of his family. And so what is he doing in rejecting the ways of his family? Well, he goes and he marries a Canaanite woman. And not only is he rejecting his family, but he's rejecting what God said about who he should marry. So this has nothing to do with marrying people from other cultures. It's all about the worldview. So he was marrying someone who did not follow God. And not only did they not follow God, but they were, the Canaanites, a wicked, a depraved, and a very immoral people. So part of their worship involved temple prostitution, as we're going to see play out in this chapter. As a people, they engaged in idolatry and child sacrifice and incest and murder and a number of other things that I didn't even feel comfortable mentioning in a church service. And so clearly, marrying someone like this is going to impact their relationship with God. But even worse, it's going to impact their children's relationship with God as well. And so I want to take this moment as sort of, I want to pause and just talk for just a second, use this as a teaching moment for the young folks here. Lifeway Research put out a study in 2019 about kids who go off to college, and it found that 66% of young adults who attended church regularly in high school stopped attending church for at least a year between the ages of 18 and 22. Another study by the Barna Group found that 1 in 3 teens who grew up Christian will continue practicing their faith into adulthood. And there's a number of different reasons this could be. For one of them, if the parents aren't living out their faith about what it means to follow Jesus and modeling it well, the kids are going to be far less inclined to continue following God when they're on their own. But for others, it simply comes down to the kids simply rejecting the faith of their family and pursuing other things. And it's very likely that growing up in high school, that they did not establish that firm foundation of being in the Word on a regular basis, of growing closer to God and all these different things. And so I want to encourage you young folks here, don't let that be you. So the habits, young folks, teenagers, the habits and actions that you establish now are going to determine how you live later on. And so if God is not real to you right now, if you're never in the Bible right now reading scripture and learning and practicing some of those spiritual disciplines like a church on a regular basis, evangelism and worship and prayer and Bible reading, then guess what's going to happen when you're on your own? Well, you're going to drift. You're going to give in to some of the influences of the world that are around you when you're not under the protection of your parents. And so I want to encourage you, don't be a Judah. Now, for the sake of time, we need to press on through our passage. And so let's go to verse 3 now. And she conceived and gave, and she conceived and bore a son. And his name, and he called her, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And she, and again, she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Chezeb when she bore him. And so we have now three sons who are born from Judah, Ur, Onan, and Shelah. And you may be saying, no, those Bible names didn't really carry into the names we use today. And they're, you're going to see there's a reason for that. And so these names are going to be important to know in just a moment. So that's the first sin, sort of rejecting the faith of your family and rejecting God. Moving on to the next group of verses, we see now the sin of selfishness. It might even be pride, selfishness, and a number of other things surrounding that. So verse 6, and Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. And then Judah said to Onan, go in to your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother. You may be wondering, I've never been told anything like that for my brother-in-law. Well, hold on a second. Now, we're not told what Ur did that displeased the Lord, but we know from what I've just mentioned that the Canaanites were a wicked, depraved people. So whatever he did was so bad that the Lord put Ur to death. So son number one, the oldest son, gone. But what in the world's going on with the dad, Judah, telling Onan, the second born, to perform the duty of a brother-in-law? And you all can breathe a sigh of relief because this is not a custom that we follow. And it's not a custom that carried into the New Testament. But what he's referring to is called the levirate marriage. And this is a custom where a widow marries her deceased brother, husband's brother, to continue on the family line. So in Israel, a big way to keep women safe was through marriage. So if the husband died, it was the rule that the brother-in-law would then marry her. So this would keep her protected. Additionally, it would continue on the family line of the deceased brother. The problem for Onan is that he is the second born. And so in that culture, the firstborn was the one that received the bulk of the inheritance. So when the oldest brother died and didn't have any kids, guess who was then in line to receive the most inheritance? Well, it's the second one. And so now, by being told to go and perform his duties, what he's being told to do is to go and perform and to lose his inheritance, that he was now in line as a second one. And so what does he do? Well, instead of simply telling her, I'm not going to sleep with you because that's going to mess up my inheritance, he takes a different approach here. Verse 9, but Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So whenever he went in to his brother's wife, he would waste his semen on the ground so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. So he does the deed, but then he practices a very old-fashioned form of birth control. In other words, what he's doing is he selfishly uses her for pleasure with no intention of getting her pregnant. And so what happens? Well, Onan now is put to death as well. So this then leads us to the third sin. It's the sin of lying. Verse 11. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up. For he feared that he would die like his brothers. And so Tamar went and remained in her father's house. So Judah wants nothing to do with Tamar anymore. He's thinking that there is no way that she is touching his youngest son. Because what's going to happen? Well, most likely, from his perspective, he's going to die. And so instead of being honest, he lies to her. He sends her back to her parents' house and says, just wait a little bit. Just wait. And this leads us to the final sin, and this is the bulk of the story right here, and that is the sin of self-reliance and sexual promiscuity. So starting in verse 12. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear sheep, she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. So, no doubt, Tamar here has been handed a bad deal. And so yes, she's in a very bad situation because the very one who's supposed to be protecting her, Judah, sends her away. But also, when she gets to the point of realizing that Judah's not going to give her a son, this leads her into to take matters into her own hands, which is not this path that she chooses is not the right path to take. So I just need to make sure that you all know that what she's doing, while it works, as we're going to see, it only works because of the grace of God and because God is accomplishing his plan. But this in no way is being told as a story to condone what she's doing. And so what is her plan? Well, she puts on the clothes of a prostitute from that culture. And then in that culture, the prostitute's face was covered. And so she then travels to an area where she knows her father-in-law will be. And she waits for him. Verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. And he turned to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come into you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" And he answered, "I will send you a young goat from the flock." And she said, "If you give me a pledge until you send it." And he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she replied, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So Judah is essentially traveling, but doesn't have any cash on hand, so to speak. So he wants to purchase on credit. So Tamar asks him for his signet, his cord, and his staff. And in a signet was the seal that was worn on the cord around a neck. And the seal was rolled over soft clay that left a unique mark showing that it was that particular person. So this mark would be used on letters that were sent to people, but also for signing documents as well. So in modern terms, it was essentially a combination of a driver's license and credit card. So continuing then in the story, verse 19, so he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. And then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on her garments of her widowhood. So Tamar's plan is successful, and then she gets out of the place. She heads home. Verse 20, then Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite, to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, And he did not find her. And he asked the men of the place, "Where is the cult prostitute who was at Enaim, at the roadside?" And they said, "No cult prostitute has been here." And he returned to Judah and said, "I have not found her." Also the men of the place said, "No cult prostitute has been here." And Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent the young goat, and you did not find her." This is sort of ironic. Judah is trying to be a man of his word to a prostitute, and yet not to his own daughter. But Tamar wasn't doing this just to get money or to get a goat. And so she disappears, and no one then knows who she is or where she is. And so we've seen all sorts of sins now carried out. And in this last part we're going to see what I call the fallout. And in verse 24, it says, "About 3 months later, Judah was told, 'Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. However, moreover, she is pregnant by immorality.' And Judah said, 'Bring her out and let her be burned.'" So Judah is being a big old hypocrite, isn't he? Even more, though, he's being a self-righteous hypocrite. And this punishment that he's wanting to carry out is not any part of a law that says that if someone does this, they must be burned. So what he's doing is just trying to sort of show his own self-righteousness. And possibly he's also thinking that this is a good opportunity to get rid of a problem for his third son. Verse 25, "And as she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, 'By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant.' And she said, 'Please identify who these are, the signet and the cord and the staff.' And then Judah identified them and said, 'She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah.' And he did not know her again." So to his credit, and there's not a lot of credit going to him here, when Judah realizes what happened and sort of that things were pointing at him, he at least admits it. And in doing so, we can safely assume that he then brought her back into the protection of his family based on the genealogy that we're going to be looking at in a little bit. And so we have a few more verses to cover, but this sort of leads us in to the question that we've been asking every week as we go through the book of Genesis: where is Christ in this passage? And there's a number of different ways that we could see Christ in this passage, but I just want to point out the most obvious, which is one of the big reasons why this chapter is in Genesis. And this is because it continues the genealogy leading to Jesus. So verse 27, when the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, she put out a hand, and the midwife took, one of the babies put out a hand. This is, by the way, from the womb, put out a hand. And the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on the hand, saying, "This one came out first." Sort of picture like one of those like horse races where you look at the picture, sort of which body part crosses the line first. So this is how they're counting who the firstborn is. But as he drew his hand back, behold, his brother came out. And she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." Therefore, his name was called Perez. Afterwards, his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand. His name was called Zerah. So this is quite the picture, isn't it? And so there's this hand poking out, and this hand then puts him in the first place. But just like with Jacob and Esau, we see that God chooses to use the younger instead of the older to continue his line, because it's through Perez that the line of Jesus will continue. And as we're going to see now in the book of Matthew chapter 1 opens with a genealogy. And let me read the first three verses. So it says in Matthew chapter 1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. And Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron. So Jesus Christ is born out of the line of Tamar and Perez. And this is amazing to me, considering the story that we've just looked at. But this leads us into the first of the two applications that I want to start to wrap up with. And so here's application number one. That no matter how insignificant you feel you might be, God can still work through you. Because Matthew chapter 1 in the genealogy, it is full of questionable, we would even call them insignificant people. We've seen the imperfections of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob come out. And then there's Tamar, which we just looked at. From a Jewish culture, Tamar did not have a lot of things going for her. For example, in the second century AD, there was a rabbi who became sort of well known for the prayer that he prayed, which is, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has not made me a Gentile, a slave, or a woman." I'm just saying it as it is. It's not me who's saying it. And yet Tamar is one, two of those, and very close to a third. And yet in the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, we see other questionable people mentioned directly or indirectly. Solomon comes from this situation of adultery and murder. Rahab is a prostitute before turning to God. Ruth is a foreigner whose husband died, and she marries and a second time and is brought into the family. So listen, if God can use people like this in a powerful way, He can use you too. In 1855, there was a quiet, humble man named Edward Kimball, and he taught a Sunday school class at his church to some teenage boys in Boston. And one day, he felt led to go and to visit one of the boys from his class who was working at a shoe store. So Kimball was not a pastor, he was not real outgoing, so he was nervous about what he was doing. He was unsure about whether he should do it, but he decided to go in. And he gathered up his courage, went up to this boy, and shared the gospel with this teenage boy. And the teenager's name was Dwight L. Moody. And Moody went on to give his life to Christ, and went on to become one of the most influential evangelists in history. Moody would preach to millions of people long before technology made it easy to do that. And it all started with a man nobody's heard of doing something, teaching teens, that feels pretty insignificant. So church, God doesn't need you to be impressive. He just wants you to be available. So are you available to him? Edward Kimball probably never imagined his name would be remembered, but the ripple effect of his faithfulness is still being felt today. So just like Tamar, just like Rahab, just like Ruth, God delights in using people who seem insignificant in the world's eyes. One last point of application, that is, that God can accomplish his will even when you mess up. And you may be saying, Kyle, you've said this before as we've been going through Genesis. And yes, there's a reason why I've said this before, because God really wants to emphasize this point to people. We've seen over and over again throughout Genesis, person after person makes a mess of their life. Abraham, who's told he will be a great nation, he gives his wife away when he's afraid. God has to step in and work it out to get her back. Isaac stubbornly tries to bless Esau, even when God said it's Jacob that's going to be used. Jacob and Esau get in this, you know, this argument here, and Esau wants to kill him. So Jacob runs for his life. Jacob's kids are a mess, as we'll see starting in chapter 37. As we see here in chapter 38, Judah is a mess as a father. Jacob's kids try to kill one of the others, Joseph, and they sell him into slavery. Judah runs off and marries a Canaanite woman. And then he sends his daughter away. The daughter-in-law turns to prostitution to achieve her goal of getting pregnant. And yet all through this craziness, it's like God is looking at the situation and he's just saying, I got this. I got this. Because he works through the insignificant and he also works through the mess ups. I think of the story of Mitsuo Fuchida, who was a Japanese captain who led the air attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. After that took place, he was a national hero in Japan. But after the war, everything crumbled, both in Japan and for him. Japan was devastated, and Fuchida was disillusioned by everything. And he later said that he was filled with anger and with guilt and with purposelessness. And so he came across a story in Japan of this Christian woman named Peggy Covell, who had shown kindness to Japanese prisoners of war, even though they had killed her missionary parents in Japan. So why would she forgive and why would she show love to her enemies? Those questions stuck with him. And soon after, he was handed a tract titled, I Was a Prisoner in Japan. And it was written by Jacob DeShazer, who was part of the Doolittle Raid, who was captured and tortured in Japan. He later became a Christian. He forgave his captors. And through his testimony, Fuchida began to read the Bible and learn more about Christ. And he then became a follower of Jesus Christ. And he spent the rest of his life going around sharing the gospel and even traveling to the U.S. to tell his story. And Fuchida's name is tied to one of the darkest days in American history. And his blood, or there's blood on his hands, and yet God's saying, I'm not done with him yet. And if God can work through that mess of war and regret, he can work through your mess as well. And so I want to encourage you, don't lose hope. Because no matter what you've done in the past, no matter what you are doing right now, your story is not over. So your life is not too far beyond his grace. And so if you will make yourself available to him, he can and will still use you. And others here today, maybe you feel like you are not worthy to become a Christian, that you're too bad to become a Christian, to turn to Jesus. And I just want to say, no one is. No one is. That it's only possible through Jesus Christ. And so if you turn to him and give him your life, and the Bible says that if you confess that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, that you will be saved. So turn to him, give him your life, and he will save you and forgive you of all that you've done in the past, in the present, in the future. Because God's not done with you yet. He can still use you. He can still save you. Let's go ahead and let's spend a moment now in prayer. Worship team, you can come on up.